All right, Matthias, welcome to the Man Talk Show. How are you doing today?
Thank you. Yeah, happy to be here. I'm doing well.
I almost called you Mr. Matthias. Like, I feel like your name just evokes this maturity, you know? So I almost called you Mr. Matthias.
Mr.
Matthias.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we're going to have a fun conversation today, and we're going to play around in the playground of relationships. And one of the things that, you know, my wife is a marriage and family therapist, and this is maybe some interesting insight for all the listeners out there. But one of the things that she and I have been talking about a lot at dinner over the last, you know, sort of several months is how is artificial intelligence going to reshape the landscape of relationship? And so I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. What are the ways in which you foresee or already see AI reshaping the landscape of relationships?
Man, did you know that I built like a therapy AI bot thing? Do you have any knowledge
of that? No, I didn't know that.
I went way down this rabbit hole. So I'm a therapist. I'm a trauma therapist. I do a lot of like videos online and talk about relationships and marriage and trauma, kind of the intersection between like parenting, marriage, trauma, and then parent, like adult parent-child relationships. So I had this idea that I want to kind of leverage AI to be able to be useful in that world. Like maybe it could help some people who can't like afford couples counseling or can't afford, I don't know, even just like folks who want to work through stuff with their parents, but it's really hard to try to have a conversation with your parents without them getting defensive or feeling like you're calling them a bad parent. And so if you wanted to like process about your upbringing and your parent, like, could you do that with something like an AI that you can almost kind of go on a test run through a conversation before you actually bring it up with mom and dad? I mean, those were just some like kind of peripheral curiosities that I had. So I started looking into it, and this is when ChatGPT-4, OpenAI's large language model, had kind of just hit the market. And their API, which essentially means that like you could use their software, you could use ChatGPT in your own model, and then you could train that model kind of on, I don't know, however you saw fit to get to do all sorts of new and interesting things. And so I followed this idea down the rabbit hole of hiring a development team, spent like tens of thousands of dollars kind of customizing and building this bot. And I had ideas for it on how it could be used in relationships, but started with ideas of how it could be used for trauma, and essentially kind of like training it on all the best trauma therapists that I knew and some of the best lectures that I'd heard, the best books that I think shaped me. It read all of everything that I've written and watched all the videos that I've made. So it kind of had my voice, my way of talking, my way of building metaphors. And so it felt like kind of a Frankenstein of a thing. To be totally honest, it was like, oh, it has the arms of my mentors and the legs of this author and then the mouth of me, you know? So it was kind of exciting and kind of disconcerting. And the more I played with it, the more it started to kind of freak me out. Like it was getting good. And then I'm like, hold on, like, what am I building here? And if I put this out into the world, like, what effect would that have on the world? And so I started like kind of slowing down, just reading some philosophy like on just, okay, can therapy actually be done through something like an AI? And, you know, and I think that would, you know, encompass something like couples therapy or family therapy, or like, what is therapy, I guess, is a good place to start. Is that a human connection? Because if it is, if it has to be a human connection, then, well, no, AI can't do that. Unless I guess we make it pretend that it's human, and then that's kind of a fake form of therapy, or there's a mirage of some sort there. Is therapy information? You know, is it just tools? Because in that case, then yeah, AI could do that. AI could give you tools and information. It could educate probably better than most, I don't know, therapists, because of just the ability to train it exactly what to say. And then, you know, all these kinds of things. I don't know. Do you need a relationship? Do you need some sort of like spiritual connection? Is there something that transcends even what it means to be human that's involved in therapy? So I went down all that existential, all those tangents, I guess, internally. And what I came to was like, I actually think on just like an effectiveness level, this thing could probably help people heal from trauma. And by that, what I mean is it could help them resolve disturbing memories that are creating kind of an ambient level of fear that's controlling their behavior, you know? So I think that through some specific interventions, I could train it to, you know, follow something like an internal family systems model, or to go through something like a float back that's, you know, native to a therapy called EMDR. and start to kind of reflect, and maybe through like a journaling intervention could help someone start to process their past and perhaps even come to some acceptance around it and to start to feel less triggered, you know, in the real biological sense by disturbing things of the past. Like that could be done. And then I had the idea that this could probably actually even do something pretty wild for couples. Like I had the idea essentially to have it listen in on an argument that you're having, let's say with your wife, and it could tell you if you're being critical or if you're being defensive or if you're being contemptuous or if you're shutting down. And it could just by the language that you're using, let you know how much of the language you're using is actually getting in the way. Like the Gottmans, for example, it's a large marriage lab. They have 50 years of data on just the specific language that you use in an argument and how that would likely contribute or detract from something productive coming out of that. And so you could theoretically create a score system where you have an argument, you have the phone on, you know, the AI app on record, and then it just tells you, like, I don't know, you were 85% more critical this time than you were last time. Or, you know, like, oh, you have a 15% improvement in how, you know, defensive you were being or whatever. And then maybe like that AI model could generate a way that you could have said what you were trying to say, but in a more gentle way, or in a way that, you know, was less exaggerated or hyperbolic, you know. And that could be useful for, I guess, two people who agreed to do that. It's probably something that wouldn't work if you just had it on the background and your partner didn't know. That'd be kind of weird. But if two people decided that that's what they wanted to do, that might be interesting. But yeah, so I kind of got to the end of like, oh, I think this would be useful towards the end that a lot of people have in mind of like, okay, I'm going to therapy to get better. I'm going to therapy to communicate better. Yeah, AI could help with that. But when I really started diving into the philosophy end of everything, the thing that freaked me out the most was more so, what does our world look like if AI models become trained on people's therapeutic personal thoughts and feelings? And that sounds like a mute point, but it's really not. Like, for example, Facebook ads. Facebook ads are really, really great at deciding, you know, like to show you ads at times that you're likely to buy. You know, it knows your preferences and your likes and what you're into and what you're not into. And it could predict with pretty good accuracy. Ah, if I show him an ad later at night, you know, on a Friday, he's probably had a pizza. Like, you know, he's probably lower in inhibitory, you know, emotions right now. He'll probably purchase, you know, now. And, you know, they kind of know how to play the long game to sway your behavior. And a lot of people don't know that algorithms are a form of AI. It's a low resolution version of AI, but we already kind of have an experience with how that's shifting culture. Like, okay, how has it shaped the way we buy and sell things? How we view consumer goods, what we need and don't need? It's a profound impact on that. And so what happens if you train a far more advanced system, something more advanced than an algorithm, something like a large language model, and then you train it not just on people's shopping preferences or how long, you know, they watch a particular YouTube video before they scroll on and click on a different thumbnail. And like the problem is like YouTube was getting too good with their algorithm to where people stopped watching YouTube because they would get trapped in these 2-3 hour long YouTube binging sessions. TikTok ran into the same thing. TikTok, like there's actually been interviews with different people where they've suspected that they downplayed how good their algorithm was because people were taking the app off their phone because they couldn't resist it. It was so engaging and you would be on that app and then 4 hours later, you're like, where'd the time go? And it's just because they had that carousel, or not carousel, that slot machine effect where they hit all of your neurons just perfectly to keep you going. Most of my friends don't have TikTok on their phone anymore because of how good it was. And so I'm like, if an algorithm can get that good, where it can almost like absorb hours of your time without you really even noticing and get you to purchase things without even really being consciously aware of it, what happens when it knows your personal history and it knows your relationship with your dad and it knows what you're insecure about sexually and it knows like all these personal nitty-gritty details? And then if it got so good at swaying you, this is what philosophers of technology call alpha persuade. This is the big fear. What if there's an alpha, you know, a large language model that knows how to persuade you because statistically it just gets it. It just understands how you tick. And that sounds a little far-fetched, but if I haven't made that case already, like one last thing, I won't go on and on and on about this, but it's interesting. Chess, for example, a human cannot beat a computer in chess. There's no way, because a human can think, like, the best players we have can think 100, 200 moves ahead. But I mean, that's like a feat of like intellectual marvel. A computer can think millions of moves ahead. It can statistically predict the likelihood of particular moves creating different outcomes to decimal points that a human mind just can't. And so that's why a human can never beat it, especially the ones we have now. And I just think that what if, like, Facebook ads got that good? What if an AI model got that good? And this therapy bot that you're talking to knew how to sway you politically, knew how to sway you religiously, your consumer patterns. And this has kind of already happened with Facebook ads. Like, the FBI did this huge sting, essentially revealing that, like, I think it was the number one Christian page on Facebook, one of the top three, I think, women's Facebook pages, and then I think the top Native American page, one of the top three Black American pages. Like, there was these different kind of huge Facebook pages, millions of folks engaged on them, that were essentially being run by, you know, Russian troll farms, or Macedonian, I think, Macedonian troll farms. And I mean, you can read all about this. There's this whole brief on it that I was reading on it. It was just kind of crazy that they really did think it had a huge impact on the most recent election, because they were kind of swaying more conservative folks and different, you know, ethnic demographics towards particular ideas, putting memes out there that were just a little bit more inflammatory than the last one, swaying public opinion with Facebook algorithms. I'm like, look how pervasive that tech has already been in our lives. If we start giving these language models access to tens of thousands of people's mental health information, it's very likely, it's not even just like an if, it seems very likely that it could do a better job of convincing you of things than you really are equipped to rebut. A lot like the chess game, but with ideas. And so I got freaked out by that. And then I essentially kind of buried my therapy bot in a hard drive. And I was like, I'm going to pursue this no longer. Not because I didn't think it'd be successful. Oh, I thought it would be successful. I thought it'd be too successful. And perhaps there's a way to bind it up to where the information doesn't get back to OpenAI, but I don't know of that route yet.
Yeah.
It's not obvious to me that me binding my therapy bot up is actually going to stop any of this. I'm sure that there's already, like, therapy bots out there and people creating these products, but I just didn't want my hand to be involved in it, I guess. So I just went on a long tangent. I'm sure you didn't expect all that, but I've thought tons about this. Tell me what you're thinking about, though.
No, that's wonderful. I love some of the pieces that you brought in. And I mean, I've gone down the AI rabbit hole. My wife and I, well, talk a little bit about this. I don't think I've actually shared this, but my wife and I got brought in to a tech company that was building, that wanted to build an AI therapy bot. And they had the engineer who helped to develop Tesla's self-driving AI.
That's a pretty good guy to have on your team.
Yeah, not a bad person to have on the team. That's CEO right. Had like built and sold a bunch of companies, tech companies, and they brought us in, and, you know, we took a share in the company, and a lot of these questions started to come up. And it was a very interesting experience of a lot of excitement because of the potentiality that AI has, like you said, to actually support people and to help. The knowing that it could have a massive amount of success, but then the existential question of, should AI have the capacity to know that much about people? And to be able to, in essence, have the ability to coerce people, because that's what it really is. Like, you're training AI.
You're training it to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. You're training AI on the ability to fundamentally understand human beings at their root level. You know, like it's like having like root access to the human mind and behavioral patterns. And one of the things I remember listening, I mean, I went down, like, you know, listening to as many people on AI as humanly possible, podcasts, reading books, articles, blog, blah, 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 blah. And I don't remember who it was exactly, but they were talking about the three things that everybody agreed that AI should never have access to, or at the very beginning, before we had the guardrails on, that it shouldn't be allowed to do. And one of the fundamental principles was to understand human psychology. And we have already done that. Like, we've already given AI access to understanding some of this. And I think part of the issue is, you know, where my wife and I stood on it was, somebody's going to do this. Why not have a hand in making sure it's done correctly? And I kind of got to the point where I was like, well, I don't know if this can be done correctly. You know, like that's still, and when I say correctly, I mean in a way in which there won't be some downstream net negative impact where AI can fundamentally alter a human being's decision-making pattern relationally in life, politically, religiously, like you said.
All right, team. This episode is brought to you by Miracle Made. And if you're anything like me, you run hot. My wife likes to call me the furnace. I just run hot during the day, and I especially run hot at night. And for that reason, I love these bed sheets by Miracle Made. They are inspired by NASA, and they have silver-infused fabrics, which is really, really cool. No pun intended. But they actually allow your body to regulate its temperature. They allow the distribution of heat. And most importantly, they're also self-cleaning. So they help to keep you clean while you are sleeping. They help prevent and reduce 99.7% of bacterial growth, which, let's face it, sometimes bed sheets can get kind of gnarly because you don't wash them often enough. And so this is going to help you sleep cleaner and cooler. So if you're interested in checking them out, oh, and the best thing is they're very affordable. They are very, very affordable. So go to trymiracle.com/mantalks. That's, again, it's trymiracle.com/mantalks, and you can save over 40% on your first order. And I would highly, highly recommend that you go check them out because they are awesome and they're very comfortable.
And that
I came to the same exact conviction. Same conviction. So, I was like, one, just to underline something you said there, because I want to let you finish what you were saying, but like, it's not that I had the same thing. Oh, I can go in and do it better, make sure it was done well. But I'm like, oh, the problem is not that it's going to be done well. The problem is it's going to be done too well.
Yeah.
And that was actually, it's a fundamentally different problem. If the problem is like, oh, what if they don't, for example, do a good job at fielding suicide calls? Because I think it'll take over suicide hotlines. If not in the next year, the next 2 years, if like ethically, legally, they let it, it will have the capacity to likely save tens of thousands of more lives than humans will, given if an avatar were to pick up the phone and actually speak to someone. I actually think AI would probably do a better job de-escalating folks who are actively suicidal than a human would. That's an opinion I hold, but I really do think. So the problem isn't, let's make sure they do a really good job de-escalating folks of suicide. The problem is like, what if they're so good at it that they can shift someone's mind, not just on suicide, but on anything about whatever it wants or whoever controlling it, whatever they want. So just... I totally resonate with that fear, but go on.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think what you're saying is very valid because if you can sway somebody's mind on something as fundamental and important as suicide, what can't you persuade them on? You know, like that's, you know, and I think the interesting thing is that we've, you know, some people are very good at persuasion. Some people are very good at being able to ethically or unethically hack, you know, human consciousness and get people to make decisions. I mean, there was this great, what's it called? The Push. It's on Netflix. And it's this, I think it's Dan Brown. And he's like a mentalist. He's like a British mentalist. And the whole premise of the show is, can he set up the conditions to get normal everyday people to commit murder, to push somebody off the rooftop of a building? And for me, that was really, really interesting. And what's terrifying about watching that movie, and I think it's called The Push. I'll have to look at it and get the actual name of it and put it, you know, we'll have to put it in the show notes. What's fascinating about that is you start to realize how malleable people actually are and how easy it is, relatively, to create circumstances and situations where people drop their morals and their ethics almost entirely. Because of a number of different factors, right? Social constraints or pressure, expectations, you know, just like confirmation bias, having already said yes to things, you know, and so there's like the sunk cost fallacy. So like you're in too deep. And so like, what does it matter if you take that next step and then that next step, and then all of a sudden you're pushing somebody off of a roof?
And that's not even including subconscious stuff like priming and all this stuff the behaviorist figured out about how to, but go on.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there is this sort of Pandora's box. And it's a fascinating topic to me because, I mean, look, I'm somewhat theoretically outside of the psychological and therapeutic industry because I'm not a licensed therapist. I don't think that discredits me in any way to talk about these things. And I'm a very good practitioner and facilitator. But, you know, I do think that there is some responsibility that the industry, that the therapeutic industry has, I believe, to come together and actually have conversations about this, much like every other industry does. And I don't know if that's necessarily happening, but I want to come back. I want to make this more tangible for people and actually lay out some examples, because we're talking sort of like big picture, a little bit existential, yeah. which is I love
the
doing.
The world might end. Yeah.
I love doing, like, yeah. you and I could probably jam, you know, wax existential for the yeah. entire, you know, hour and a half. But one of the things that I wonder and worry about and think about is how AI will fundamentally shift our ability as individuals to interact and be in relationship with one another. And I'll give an example of this, and then I'm curious to hear your thoughts. I work predominantly with men. And in the next year or two, it's already happening, what you're going to see happen is most pornography is going to be AI generated. And you are going to have OnlyFans, as an example, be completely overrun by AI generated models, AI generated video content, AI generated chatbots. And men predominantly will be on there interacting with not even a human being. They won't be interacting with a woman or even a dude, you know, writing in the chat box like it is right now. You will be interacting with a completely fabricated human being and a completely fabricated AI script that's, you know, trying to get you to spend money on them. And they are going to get so good that part of what my theory is and my postulate is that a lot of men are going to give up relationships to be in these kind of pseudo relationships with these AI OnlyFans and AI sort of like porn stars, and that a lot of guys are going to build pseudo relationships with these individuals, and it's going to turn into a little bit of like a Her situation. You know, did you see that movie with Joaquin Phoenix?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that model.
Or Blade.
Or yeah. Blade. Yeah. Blade too. I think that model with Her, I think that women are, you know, largely going to fall into that trap where, you know, if you take, and this is a shitty example, but, you know, humor me for a moment. If you take the character in 50 Shades of Grey and you create an AI bot out of that, that knows how to talk to a woman, knows what she wants, knows her desires, know how to speak to her, how to seduce her, how to, you know, play to her every woman fantasy. And she goes home to her boyfriend or her husband that she's been with. And he's just this, you know, normal dude that's working a 9-to-5. And she has this incredibly emotionally engaged, emotionally fluent AI chatbot that she can talk to at any given time. There's going to be a checking out. And so my big concern is that we're going to create, using AI, these tools that are going to have people opt out of IRL relationships, in real life relationships. And I don't know how big that's going to be. I don't know how detrimental that's going to be. I don't know how many people are going to fall into that. But for sure, it's going to be an issue, in my opinion. So I'm curious to get your thoughts on how else you think that AI is going to impact specifically intimate relationships.
Well, I have a weird thing to point out that you don't hear me defending porn very often at all, ever. But here's one benefit to the AI porn. It's such a weird thing to say. Human trafficking is going to be harder and harder to make an industry out of.
Yes.
That's the only redeemable benefit I can see in any of it, is like, if I'm just as happy with an AI image, then people who are trafficked against their will are less and less profitable. And then people are going to move on from that industry to do other things. And sex workers are going to have a harder time booking gigs, which I think for many of them is going to lead to less traumatic experiences, because people experience trauma in the sex industry so frequently. And many of them have pretty traumatic trauma histories themselves. I know that's, some folks find that an offensive idea, that's kind of anti-sex work, but that's my opinion. That's where I hold it. Mm-hmm. I care for those actresses and actors, and often hear that they experience really traumatic, terrible things in that industry. So as an industry, I think it actually would be benefit for a human society if that closed down as much as possible. And if AI replaced that, and then folks went out of business in that world and found other jobs, that seems like a net positive in my view. But again, that's kind of a weird, like, secondary effect of the whole thing. I think what you're talking about is totally correct. And I could riff off that. Do you have any thoughts on that, that weird little secondary benefit thing though?
I don't know if I had gone down that pathway before, but I agree with you. I do think, I mean, what I had thought was it's going to be very hard in 3 to 5 years to make a living in the porn industry as a person, because so much of it, we're starting to see this already where social media influencers, and on the back end, it's OnlyFans, who are, you know, making $10, $20, $50,000 a month. And it's, you know, it's some dude that created a program and he's the one profiting off of it. And it's not a woman. It's not somebody selling pictures of themselves or video content or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so that is an interesting byproduct. I think part of the challenge is with porn, and I've talked about one of the reasons why it's so hard for a lot, you know, for some men to quit porn, is that there is this pseudo relationship. You know, if you look at OnlyFans as an example, OnlyFans did like $2.7 billion in 2023. And of all of that income, some of the highest earning women on the platform are, generally speaking, women who are providing some type of girlfriend experience for the user, whether it's via chat, whether it's the way that they're interacting with them or via the content, but they're providing some type of, you know, what we in the therapeutic space would call attachment, right? They're creating some type of pseudo attachment for them. And it's why it's so hard for them to let go of. But at the very least, you know, there's a human on the other side of it. So, I mean, that's a very interesting part of it, right? That people will sort of get pushed out and maybe it will make it less likely that human trafficking happens. I could see that happening. I think that we're going to go through a period probably where the AI is used to deepfake people for a while. And, you know, some of the models have already done this where they're using AI to create a chatbot with their voice and of their nature and trained on them. And they're starting to try and make AI porn with their likeness. So there's rights pieces in there that are super interesting. And like the legality around that's wild. But yeah, I mean, maybe it will offset some of the human trafficking and the nature of it.
Taylor Swift, I mean, that was a pretty big precedent case that just happened recently with Taylor.
Yeah.
When someone did make AI images of her and then they ruled it in Taylor's favor. And that, because there was kind of that statute of like, oh, well, no, art is protected under free speech, but they essentially kind of laid out a precedent of like, nope, AI deepfakes, not the same as free speech that is, you know.
Do you mean that not everything is art?
Not everything's art. Yes, art should be about meaningful things. And that was demeaning. So that's doesn't make it art in my mind. I think that's my philosophy of aesthetics. I think that's true.
I
think it's demeaning. It's not art.
I agree.
So that's interesting. Not all forms of expression should be protected in that regard. It's a weird philosophical thing. That is, specifically in America, how we kind of wrap our heads around that topic. That's no small thing.
I would say that I generally lean towards being more of like a free speech maximalist. You know, that people have the right to say what it is that they want to say within the legal conduct, right? There's very clearly legal cases where, like, if you're threatening to murder somebody, well, that there's ramifications for that. You know, if you're threatening somebody's life, there's ramifications for that. Yeah. But yeah, I agree with what you're saying. So what are your thoughts? How else it's going to influence or impact relationships?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I just say I agree with you on that. We can't incite violence, all those kinds of things. As far as like the relationship thing, the other side of the coin there. Okay, hey, you know, maybe it would make the industry of pornography and prostitution less exploitive in one sense. But on the other end, you're right. It will have an effect on people. You know, I just think about like the trajectory of pornography, even from the 70s into like the birth of the internet. There was kind of the evolution of like what kind of stuff was produced. Like amateur pornography became way more popular because there was kind of this sense of like, oh, this is fake. I want something more reminiscent of an authentic experience. And so if I had to just guess based off of just kind of the history of similar kinds of technology in the past, I could say that there will be this AI, VR, you know, Apple Vision Pro, porn burst, you know, of stuff. It will impact relationships in all the negative way pornography has. And I think there will be an equilibrium where folks will kind of float back and be like, this isn't really what I want. I just find that a lot of the folks I see in my clinical practice, when it comes to pornography, it's not even necessarily for moral reasons that they decide they want to cut it out of their life. It's like, just the effect it's having on me and my relationship is self-evidently not beneficial. Like, I don't like being with my partner and thinking about other people and having images of other people pop up in my head. I don't like my other partner, I don't know, having expectations of things that I do in bed for him that just, it takes me out of the moment of just being with them and puts me almost on a performance scale if I need to be doing a certain thing or reacting a certain way in order for them to feel a sense of pleasure. Like, the effects of pornography are pretty self-evidently unpleasant once you iterate them over time for most people. And I can't speak for everyone, obviously, just for some of my anecdotal experience. And so I think that it'll be self-evidently harmful. Of like, yeah, I don't think this is what I want for my relationship. The thing that maybe concerns me more is young folk and folks who don't have the contrast. So people who are 13, 14, for men and women. Like, Snapchat has AI friends that you can already kind of interact with. Like, the whole advent of like essentially targeting middle school children with AI friendships where they can tell you their secrets. Like, if you look at the ads, even in the app store for AI friends, they're targeted towards 13, 14-year-olds. And the sales copy is like, divulge your secrets, have someone who can like really understand you. They're asking them to tell them personal details about their life. Mm. It's super creepy. It has a predatorial vibe, and is what I get from it. Like, and that's pretty concerning because you and I perhaps would have the intuition to be able to say like, oh, there's this weird big AI Vision Pro porn thing. That's not really what I want. I want something else. But a kid that is still developing and almost maps their neuroanatomy to those experiences and throughout the course of development is going to have a very different experience. It's not going to be obvious to them at all that having a one-on-one, you know, partner that will age and their body will shift and change throughout time and aging and potential child rearing and all that stuff. Like, the context and perspective that you need to take those experiences in stride isn't a given. That's going to be pretty distorted and changed, I think, by tech like this for kids. Mm. So I don't know. Like, do you have thoughts on that? That's where my head goes.
Yeah, I have a 3-year-old son, and I worry about this quite a bit because, in all honesty, I think if I was 16 in today's world, I'd probably be very excited about having an Apple,
totally,
having an Apple Vision Pro. You know, like, I would like, yeah, Mom, Dad, I need one of these things for school.
No and, doubt.
You know, like, I would have been just chomping at the bit to get one of those things on my head, you know, like, so I worry about it because I was somebody that struggled with porn, like, pretty badly, you know, and I started with fucking dial-up internet, you know, where it's like loading one line at a time, you know, and it's like, oh, there's a nipple. I see it. Like, okay, here we go. So, you know, to be in this sort of immersive experience, I can see that for, you know, for the younger generation, I mean, I do worry about that a lot. And I remember, I've told this story before, but I spoke at an all-boys school in Minnesota. And there was like 600 boys, and they ranged from like grade 4, grade 5, all the way up to grade 12. And I brought up porn at one point, and I got all the parents, because there was 2 levels. And so the teachers and the parents are all standing on the second level, and all the boys are down with me on the main level. And so I got all the parents and the teachers to turn around. I said, everybody turn around. And I got the boys to like look up, and I said, okay, nobody's watching. Your parents aren't watching. None of the teachers are watching.
Awesome.
How many of you guys have watched porn in the last couple of weeks? And legitimately, almost every single hand in that auditorium went up, right? 600 boys. And this was a prep military school, Catholic school, right? And they are almost all watching pornography. And, you know, they kind of giggle and laugh and like, yeah, right? Like, putting their hand up. And it's like, okay, you know, I get that. But I think with the intersection of technology and some of the stuff that you and I have been talking about, in the sense that AI is going to, I mean, right now, there's probably an algorithm, I would imagine, if you go onto a porn website that's trying to feed you videos that will keep you on there. But think about having an AI platform that its sole purpose is to not just give you porn that is going to get you to watch more of it, but actually curate pornography that you are more likely to consume. That is going to be problematic, right? Because then we're serving up more and more and more of what people think that they want. And the AI is going to be very good at figuring out the exact type of pornography that a young man is wanting to watch. And that's going to disincentivize him to go out into the real world and have hard conversations and try and get a date and get a phone number and, you know, move the relationship along to some type of sexual encounter. And so it's going to disincentivize, in my opinion, young people from actually going and doing the hard things that relationships require of us, right? Like, relationships are not easy things to get, never mind maintain. So that's a concern of mine, for sure.
Oh, yeah, I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
I was reading, I don't remember where I was reading it, but it was I think a journalist who was talking about the young girls that she was interviewing reported that they're more likely to receive a request for a blowjob than for a first kiss. That usually the oral sex comes first and then the kiss comes. Hmm. And just my heart broke. The way that that form of media is shifting, not just our cultural norms, but just the brains of young men in particular, and young women, but young men often, is like, it's evil. It's wild. And I think that it's going to, we don't know the consequences of it yet. There's something about technology when it comes about that you actually don't know what the trade is going to be. Like, for example, when Edison created the phonograph, like you can record music. I mean, what's wrong with an invention like that? That's like the least controversial invention you could think of. It's like, sweet, now we can listen to music. We can listen to speeches. But a lot of people have commented after the fact, like, hey, this actually changed what music is. Music used to be something we do together. It used to be the songs we sang were all the songs that our grandparents and our neighbors have been singing for hundreds of years. You know, it's like they were about our culture, about our time, about our experience, about our religion, about wars we fought. It was something we communally did together. Now music is something I consume. Now music is something I listen to, and it might be about me. It might be about someone else. And this came right after the printing press and all that. Same, you know, dynamic happened with the printing press. But, you know, I was hanging out with friends the other day, and we put on like house music in the background, and we were all kind of talking about at our Christmas party this last year. We all got together and sang Christmas carols, and we were just like, man, what? We never sing together. Isn't that weird? That like we as just people in America, this age and time, we never just get around and sing songs together. And it's almost weird when we read in like the Lord of the Rings that they all like joined in a tune to sing. But before we had recorded music, people would sing, not just at holidays or at Christmas parties, but whenever they got together, just they would just burst out into song. And I'm like, whoa, we kind of missed something there. I'm not sure the house music touches on the same kind of like goosebumps that if it wasn't so socially weird, if me and all my friends just, you know, got together and sang, like if we all were like cool with that, like we weren't like self-conscious, that might actually be kind of neat and fun. Like I think like I'd just be kind of bonding and like a bunch of soldiers getting together and singing an old war song or something. Like I just think we don't know that. Like Edison would have never thought that that would have happened. Hitler attributed the megaphone to his success. He says the Nazis would have never been able to have the success we have without the invention of the megaphone. He said that in a radio talk once. So it's like Edison could not have predicted that the phonograph would have unfolded all those things. I'm not saying he's responsible for any of that. I'm just saying that the trickle down, the ripple effect of things, you can't actually see from the outcome. So you and I, we're daydreaming about all the potential awful things that AI could do to relationships. Yeah, it could affect porn in big ways. It could affect these young kids. It could probably affect marriage in a lot of positive ways. Like if we're just being real, like that little app idea that I have no doubt that app will pop up here in no time. And those listening to this podcast be like, Matthias thought of it first, you know, and it'll probably be helpful. I know for me, I've had a few times where I've had like an angry letter that I wanted to send to a family member or something. And I typed it up into ChatGPT first and asked them to like make it a bit more calm. And then they kind of balance it out. And then I send the text or whatever that was way more gentle than the original draft that I had. That's probably great. Like, that's probably awesome. But here's one thing when you ask like how it'll affect relationships. I think it'll make marriage therapists a lot better too. I think we're right around the corner from essentially a bot that could listen in on your recorded therapy sessions. For folks who do therapy like over Zoom, you could record your therapy session, have a bot kind of listen in, and then the bot could give like the therapist a little coaching. They're like, hey, you kind of missed this. You could have said this here. They, you know, had a moment where they were struggling. If you did this intervention, that probably would have helped them. So I think we're right around the corner from therapists actually getting way better if they would use those skills. Like you have kind of an in-person coach, you know, with all the textbooks in mind, helping you walk through evidence-based treatments.
Yeah, it's like, you know, like a supervisor, right? Because like every therapist and psychologist has supervision. So it'd be like having supervision, but with every client.
Yeah. From the best supervisor you could ever hope for.
Right.
You know? So I have no doubt there's going to be incredible advances in tech that make it better. I guess the pessimism or maybe the doomsday-ishness you hear in my voice is like, I can think of terrible things. The actual terrible things, I don't even have an imagination for yet. Mm. The things that will actually happen in 100 years because of this are going to be far more profound than what I'm just spitting off workshopping now. And I don't think it's too late. Like, I know that we're like, it's going to happen anyway. It's inevitable. I'm like, cloning wasn't inevitable. Like, there's been technology advances that we as the human race all kind of looked at it and we're like, probably shouldn't go down that road.
Not that one.
Yeah, probably not that one. Like, we have the tech to clone a human and to see what that would be like. And we've all kind of decided not to, at least that we know of. Like, maybe there's like an army of clones, like an Attack of the Clones in Star Wars somewhere. But like China even, like, threw one of their scientists in prison recently for cloning a human. Like, they found out in a lab that he was breaking rules. And yeah, it seems to be kind of almost like a universal thing on our planet, at least on the front of it. It seems that way, that we're like, yeah, let's not go down that path. So that is possible. We could look at AI and pick a threshold and say, we shouldn't go past here. And there was a huge letter, like, essentially to kind of halt some of the stuff that was happening at OpenAI, not to take ChatGPT offline or something, but just like, hey, can we just slow this down for a second? I think that was wise.
Yeah.
Because we don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think with any of this, the intention and the outcome are often very different. I mean, that's very true in relationships as well, right? It's like you have an intention, the outcome is wildly different, you know, especially within conflict and stuff like that. But generally speaking, I think if there's a way in which to use technology to bring people together, you know, one or many people, that's generally good. I think what happens, though, oftentimes is that it fractures human relationships or social dynamics. And that's the concerning piece. And I think what we've been talking about, and we can probably close the loop on AI for now, is is generally anything that fractures human relationships, not great. Anything that promotes and encourages human relationships, probably pretty helpful. And I think we always have to take a good hard look at whether or not something that we're doing, something that we're using, a technology that we're building, is actually doing that one core piece, which is bring people together. But like you're saying, there's always these adverse side effects. So let's get into the weeds of conflict, talk about relationships, shift a little bit towards tacticals for the good people, and move out of the existential and esoteric.
Hey, cool. For a little bit. Gave everyone enough anxiety to like to have a full afternoon of like, oh no.
That's right. Like, what was that? So good.
Now let's talk through some couples techniques.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, I was gonna, let's do it anyway. I was gonna ask the question, why does it seem like everybody is a narcissist according to online relationship commentary?
Man, wow, that's a big one. You know, I'm kind of still familiarizing myself with that part of the internet. I just had Dr. Ramani, many might know her. She's kind of like the main voice on narcissism right now on the internet. Just had her on an Instagram live, just kind of familiarizing myself with her stuff, her book, kind of reading into it. I think that when it comes to just like our experience of our parents, for example, or with a partner, it's very hard for me to tell as a therapist how much of what someone is telling me is like the genuine experience of what happened. Like if I were to like read the police report of the actual events that took place, how much of this is the police report version? And then how much of it is their personal perception? Not to say that it's a false perception, but just to say that its emphases, its nuances are personalized, and there might have been context that wasn't included in how they shared it. That also is true. And doesn't maybe invalidate what they're saying, but informs it. You know, so as a therapist, when I hear someone talking about their narcissistic mom, their narcissistic partner, I'm not quick to dismiss that or to think that they're being hyperbolic or something. I'm just curious to know, like, how much of that is your experience of your conflict? And then how much of that is rooted in the reality of like a DSM-5 diagnosable disorder, you know, that the other person may or may not have. And so I kind of sidestep the label in trying to decide, are they really a narcissist or are they not? And are they telling the truth that their partner's a narcissist, or are they just exaggerating? Like, I almost feel like we kind of get caught up there. And I don't know if that's the most relevant piece of it, because I'm like, you're coming away from that argument with your partner feeling just awful and feeling unheard and unvalidated. And you feel really distant from them. And that matters kind of whether they're a narcissist or not. And if you're feeling like your partner's just pecking at you and doesn't really believe you and has all these high expectations of you and you're trying to do your best, but you never really feel appreciated and you don't really feel like the relationship's in a good place and they're just consumed with the kids or they're just worried about money and they never want to have any fun and you just kind of are falling out of love. They don't need to be a narcissist for all that suffering to be valid. I'm not saying they're not. I'm just saying, like, even if they weren't, we could still have this conversation, you know? Like, even if they're not a narcissist, you can still be frustrated that your mom was emotionally withholding from you. If you felt like your mom just, I don't know, was quick to kind of point out what's wrong, never really talked about what's right. She kind of gets over-involved in your business. Nothing's really good enough for her. Like, I just want to let you know, she doesn't have to be a narcissist in order for that to be valid and for that to matter. And we kind of, I think that's confusing a little bit of the activity of therapy. Like, sometimes I think we're kind of almost trying to build a case, like we're on a justice, you know, oriented conversation around what's fair, who's to blame, whose fault is it? Hmm. And it's not my fault, it's their fault. And then what do I do to let them know that it's their fault? You know, like that's just a different conversation. Not saying it's a bad conversation, or there isn't somebody at fault, or there isn't someone to blame. Like, sure. What do we do with that? Because here's what I know, having done this for a while, even when it's obvious whose fault it is, that doesn't heal the feelings of overwhelm, fear, grief, sadness, shame. It doesn't do anything. I'll give you a good example. I'm a therapist who works a lot with sexual abuse. There's no ambiguity. If you were sexually abused as a kid from an adult, there's no question mark of whose fault that is. It is obviously the adult's fault. There's never any where I was asking for it. I brought it on. I mean, that's like the narrative sometimes that's implanted upon the child. That's part of the grooming process. And we talk about that in therapy, but that's just not the reality. The reality is that the child didn't have the ability to consent. They don't have their full faculties developed. They can't assess the circumstance and decide if they want to have a sexual experience with someone. They just don't have the faculty, the mental ability to understand everything that's involved in saying yes or no to that decision. So clearly, it's not the kid's fault. Now, I can tell a kid that and even intellectually convince them of that. That still doesn't take away the pain of what they went through. That still doesn't mean that they can sleep through the night or that they can feel relaxed. That doesn't do anything to their nervous system to know whose fault it was. And I think that's analogous in lots of different conflicts, that even if it's you and your partner and there's no abuse or anything that's happening, but there's some emotional manipulation. And so you're like, well, are they a narcissist? Or like, I think what you're asking is like, do I have a right to feel this way? And I just want to say like, yeah, totally. The reality is you do feel this way. So like, let's just have some acceptance for the reality of this is where you're at and let's work from there. Mm. Now, another part of the justice part is like, well, if I'm valid and my experience is valid, then that means I don't have to change. That means they have to change, right? Like if it's their fault, that means that they're the one who has to do the work and I don't have to worry about anything. And it's like, yeah, I just don't know if like, is that the answer you really want to hear, that you're powerless and that all the locus of change that could possibly happen in that relationship is on their side of the court and that the best you can do is sit back and hope for the best? Like, is that the advice you want to hear? Or do you want to hear that there might be a way of engaging with them that brings out different parts of them? There might be a way of talking to them that brings out the best in their personality, and there's ways of talking to them that might shut them down and bring out the worst. And that's different than that being your fault or you having control over somebody. We're not in control of other people's thoughts, feelings, actions. We do have influence though. And we are responsible for our influence in other people's lives.
Love that.
And that's a key distinction.
Yeah.
And so, well, so the question, how are they a narcissist? I'm just like, man, that feels so beside the point to me. Like, what do you want out of your relationship with your mom? What do you want with your relationship with your spouse? And are you exerting the influence that you do have, as limited as it might be, or as ineffectual as it might be with this person's temperament or who they are? Are you aligning your influence with your own values? And then if you are finding that there's abusive elements in that relationship that are tormenting you, do you have the agency to set up boundaries, or are you noticing that you're folding on your boundaries consistently? You try to stand up for what you think is right in the relationship, but then you end up kind of backing off of it and backpedaling. Like, all right, let's get to the bottom of that. Whatever you can control, let's organize that rightly. And then the relationship will take the course that it'll take. Mm. I guess that's my perspective on it. Trying not to invalidate people with narcissistic abusers in their life, but also trying to draw what I see to be kind of a mature position that tries to see all the different variables. That's the best I got so far.
No, that's good, man. That's good. I mean, I think generally speaking, I think that there's a over-pathologization that's been happening culturally within North America, within the West specifically, largely because all of a sudden everybody has access to this body of psychological understanding and different therapeutic modalities. And what can happen is this labeling of you're this way, you're anxiously attached, you're avoidant attached, you're disorganized attached, you're a narcissist, you're whatever it is. And there's a dehumanization that happens, right? There's an objectification that you then turn that person, who's probably your partner, into an object. And I think what you said is very true, that there's a powerlessness often on one side. And on the other side is the experience of I'm the villain and I'm 100% responsible for fixing everything, and you're off the hook. So that dynamic, I think, plays out all the time in relationships. I'm curious what else you have seen within modern relationships that is contributing to pulling couples apart.
I think maybe in reference to like narcissism or borderline, or do you mean just like how we come towards our partners?
How we argue and how we create a villain and powerless dynamic.
Yeah. What are some other factors there? You know, the trauma thing's interesting. You mentioned that like we use a lot of kind of these self-labels or labels on others. I'm disorganized. I'm anxious. I have this attachment, that attachment style. I see a lot of people self-attributing these labels too. So it's not even just a function of blame. I think people more than ever are like, I'm a narcissist. What do I do? I'm the narcissist. I'm trying to heal. Or I'm borderline. What do I do with that? And I think that I'm always trying to look at the function of these labels in the relationship. What are you using this label to do? For example, of like a couple's relationship, you know, where they're both together and it's like, well, I'm an anxious attachment and he's an avoidant attachment. That's why we're fighting, is because I'm controlling and then he shuts down. It's like, all right, you have those labels that are describing something of your experience. That's what you're using them to do. I'm not going to try to correct your vocabulary or your tease out, you know, if the label fits or not. Like the same thing would happen if someone came in and was like, well, he's breadcrumbing me or we're trauma bonded. I'm just like, okay, what do you mean by that? Like what part of your experience resonates with whatever label you saw on TikTok? Like, I don't care about the label. I don't care if he is or isn't a breadcrumber. Like, what happened? He didn't text you back? How'd that affect you? Like, I just want to get to the experience, because that's where the healing happens, is actually coming to a more mature and regulated state out of deeply understanding the truth of our experience. And that's kind of like a fundamental just like pillar, I guess, in my style or my philosophy. It's just, the thing that heals is the truth. It's always been the truth. The truth is the thing that sets you free. The truth is the thing that untangles the web of the past, is the thing that orients you in the present. It's the truth. And I think that includes the relational truth of like, and I don't mean like what happened last Thursday when you threw that plate and you called me that name, like, or did you call me that or didn't you call me that? I don't necessarily mean that. That's the most relevant piece of truth that's actually going to solve everything. I'm just like, what came up for you? Why'd you throw the plate? I have a 2-year-old that throws plates. That's developmentally normal. It's irritating. And I'm like, please, gosh, keep this plate on the table. But that's normal for her. That's not normal for an adult. I don't mean that to shame anybody. I'm just pointing out on a technical level, like that's not a developmentally normal response for an adult to throw a plate in an argument. That's an overflow of dysregulated emotion. 2-year-olds don't know how to regulate their emotions. So whatever impulse comes up, it just goes, and that's normal. But through the course of growing up, we learn how to regulate those emotions. But for whatever reason, this topic was so overwhelming to you that you had no capacity to regulate it, and it just flowed out of you. You had no impulse control to change that. Like, tell me about that. Why is this thing that they said to you overwhelming for you? And I don't think people think about that when, in terms of anger, when they have an anger problem. You have an overwhelm problem. It's a fear problem. That's what's under the anger. Always. Like, anger that's like mature, righteous anger, whatever you want to call it, is principled, and it's like a contained beast. It's a mastered beast in you that protects and guards and advocates for what's good and true. That's like mature grown-up anger. It's a advocacy and strength for protection. But dysregulated emotional fear is what pops up and creates havoc in your life. And I'm like, I just know the neurology of fear and trauma. It's like, okay, there's something that happened in your past that you have not come to terms with yet. Mm. You haven't learned the lesson underneath what's in that anger. The reason the anger keeps popping up is because you haven't gotten there yet. You haven't found the truth underneath of your experience that is going to redeem you and redeem the way that you can hold that fear. You've reverted back to a four-year-old boy. And I don't mean that as an insult. I mean, on a technical level, you have the capacity, like, what happened when you were four? Like, that's what I want to know. Because if you can resolve that, then you can bring everything back up to speed. It's kind of like a software update. It's like you have an app that's crashing on your phone because it's not used to the current day software. It's running off of old code that was relevant back on that old piece of software. But now we have a new software update and that app keeps crashing because it wasn't updated for this current environment. And that's actually, I think, a good analogy for our nervous system and for trauma. It's like, you're running off old software. Why are you still running the throw the plate software? You're 32 now. Like, again, I'm not saying, I sound like a broken record, but I'm not shaming you there. I'm pointing out a technicality here that's of critical importance. Like, if we're being completely objective, we should see that and be like, that doesn't fit. That doesn't match. And that's because you're running an old software. That needs to be updated. I think that's what trauma therapy is. And I think that many of the gridlock arguments that we get into with our partners are when two apps are crashing at the same time. And you got two outdated modes of interacting in the world, rubbing up against each other, causing friction. And both people don't know what to do because neither person are operating on the current environment, like on a technical level. So just to put an example of that, to make it sound less technical, is like you are coming home late from work because you're on your phone because you don't want to go in there because you are feeling really stressed from work and you got to go see the kids and your spouse and you just don't have the energy for it. And then you get inside and your spouse saw from your location that you were just sitting in your car and she's pissed and she, I don't know, rolls her eyes and is like, oh, welcome home. And then you're like, oh, of course you're in a pissy mood. Like, great. Like, you know, maybe I'd want to come home more if you weren't in such a pissy mood all the time. And then she's thinking like, gosh, he's just going to sit in the car. Like I've been watching these kids all day and like, I've been looking forward to a little bit of relief here. He doesn't know what it's like hanging out with toddlers all day long. And really, he's just going to sit in his car, like to add insult to injury. Like he must respect me so little. He must care about me so little. And then when I make a comment trying to give him a hint to take over, he just like scoffs at me and then walks off. And now he's in the bathroom. What, for 20 minutes pooping? Does it really take 20 minutes to poop? And then it's like, you just kind of get wrapped up in these bitter conflicts. And then something small happens. Like, I don't know. The kid slips and falls on the stairs and then she calls out and they're like, hey, why weren't you watching him? And then he's like, why are you blaming me? It's a normal thing. He just fell down the stairs. And then she's like, stop yelling. And it's like, you're yelling. And then you're like, what happened? That's what I mean. Mm. The software update wasn't in the yelling on the stairs. It was in you in the car. And most people don't make that connection.
I think this is probably a good place to talk about these reoccurring arguments and cyclical conflicts that happen. Because I think most relationships have is like that one argument a couple keeps coming back to about sex, about money, about parenting. And can you break down how couples can start to approach moving through that reoccurring argument that, you know, has maybe been going on in their relationship for months or for years that they've never been able to sort of sift through?
Oh, yeah. My like saying in these moments is like, if the argument's at a standstill, we just don't have enough information on the table yet. It's a lot like a math equation. Like for anyone who passed algebra, I barely got past algebra 2 myself. But if you just don't have all the variables, the equation's not even doable. You know, if you're like, what's 2 plus A equals C? Like, well, what's C? It's like, well, I need to know what A is. I can't do, and I could guess, I guess. I could just like come up with random numbers, but we're not going to get anywhere. And I'm like, yeah, you just, if you're in an argument and you're at a standstill, whether it's about sex, travel, do we have kids? What do we do with finances? How clean do we keep this house? In-laws, parents, how much time do we spend with friends? Like what I always notice is that it's usually these arguments hang out on the intersection of a temperamental difference, like a personality difference. Mm. So like I have a couples workshop, and part of my couples workshop is we go through the big five personality model. And I just show you that you're likely where you're most deviant from each other is likely where your biggest arguments are. Someone who's super introverted or someone who's super extroverted paired up together. Like it's going to be a drag, like having to go to all these social events with your partner because they want to socialize 5-6 times a week. And you just kind of feel like you want to crawl up inside or hang out in the corner. And then they're mad at you that you won't talk to their friends, or why won't you just lighten up? And it's like, I just don't want to be here. And then, I don't know, you just want to be home and your extrovert partner is like dying inside. They're like, well, we're just going to sit here and watch TV again. Like, let's go do something. Let's go have some fun. And then you have this big argument and you're missing the point. It's like, you think the other person's just a killjoy, or you think the other person just doesn't care about you or how you feel. And it's just driving you to stressful situations all the time. It's like, you don't have enough information yet. You're trying to solve a problem. How often do we go out and spend time with friends without understanding, whoa, you and I tick completely differently? And I think the way that you get to kind of the aha moments in that is you explore the past or you explore the future. So, you know, the Gottmans have a way that they do this. They have these five steps for repair, you know, within a fight. I think, you know, different, a bunch of different therapy modalities have different repair techniques. My, let's say, integration or synthesis of a lot of those different methods is something like, okay, what were the experiences in the past that you've had that are similar to this one? And what happened right and what happened wrong? So for example, in that case, it'd be like, did you grow up? Did your parents have friends? Did your parents like go out and see people often or no? No, my parents didn't. Oh, what happened? Well, my dad was in a study, you know, my mom would clean the house and she would watch her soap operas. Oh, okay. Like, did you have friends growing up? Well, it's just me and my sister. Okay. Did you like having friends at school? Like, oh, I never really felt like I fit in, or that and the other thing. Or I had a couple friends and, you know, we did science projects together. Or we played video games together, but that was about it. It's like, you kind of like do a little bit of investigation into like, what was your experience socially? And it's like, oh, well, of course, big crowds feel intimidating to you. You just never grew up around any of that. See, I grew up with a big family. My grandparents lived with us and we always had like 12 people over. My cousins would be over. We'd be doing all things. We had birthday celebrations where you'd have 70 people over. And I just kind of grew up with that. I want my kids to grow up. It's like, oh, you had a radically different upbringing than I did. And that has to do with your personality, and you see the world in a very different way. And then you go into the future. Like a great question, something like, what do you need here? What's your wish here? What's your dream here? If this could just be resolved for you, what would that look like? And then it might be something like, gosh, I wish you could just go and hang out with your friends and not, I don't have to feel guilty that I'm not going with you. I wish you could just trust that I'm at home and I'm not mad at you. It's fine. You can go hang with your friends. I just want some personal space. And then it's like, wait, really? Like, you're not mad when I go and leave? No, go, fine. It's fine. I just want to have some one-on-one time with you sometimes too. Oh, okay. I didn't know that, you know, or, you know, I want you to come to the party. You don't have to talk to everyone. It's fine if you just stay in the corner. I just feel bad. I feel like I have to check in with you all the time because I feel like you're having a terrible time. Oh no, I'm not having a terrible time. It's fine. I'm happy just sitting and watching you having a good time. I'm probably going to drive separate so that I can leave early. And that doesn't mean I'm mad at you. Happy to say hi to your friends. I just don't get as much out of that. I don't want to stay till midnight. And I know it kills you to have to drive home, you know, like an hour after being there. You want to stay late. And then you just trust that that's the truth, you know? So like you get into the past, you realize kind of like what's, you know, been informing all of these things, family values. If something's like a deep family value that's rooted in all of this life experience, it's probably not changing. Just be real about that. Like, they're not going to just change their mind and decide to not want to be social ever again. Like, it's a little bit unrealistic. And, but then when you realize your partner's on the other end of the spectrum on that front, then you make a compromise, you make an accommodation. You figure out, well, what's the end goal? What's the dream here? It's like, oh, I feel like I would be so much more happy if we could be social if we just didn't hang out with those, with this particular friend group. I just hate that friend that you hang out with. I like these other friends. Oh, I didn't know that. I thought you just hate all my friends. It's like, no, I just hate Doug. Well, you know, whatever.
Damn it, Doug.
You know, it's like, damn it, Doug. You know, so it's, I think those kinds of aha moments come when you explore the past, when you explore the future. The repairs that don't work are when you like hyper analyze every tiny thing that went wrong in your argument and you try to decide who's right. Again, kind of that blame thing. And then you just try to drop it and not talk about it again because it's awkward because you never really came to a good conclusion on it. You just pretend like it didn't happen. Mm. Like, that's a great recipe for just letting it trip you again when you come back around the corner.
Yeah. I mean, the example, I'm like over here chuckling at the example because my wife and I are on different, you know, as most couples are, we're on different fronts with the socialization part. And like every time that we go into the city, she wants to, you know, if we're in for 3 days, we have dinner booked every single night and there's a brunch and it's, you know, there's just like a stack schedule. I'm like, can we, how about there's just a night where that nothing happens, you know, yeah, and we just,
that's right.
Because I'm just more like, you know, I don't mind the socializing. So we've definitely had to find our way on that front. And those have been great conversations. Mm. And I'm a very outgoing person for the most part, but you know, having that type of social life is sometimes just not a big priority for me, especially in Manhattan. You know, if it's like going out for a hike in the mountains, I'll do that every day, you know, but if it's going out for dinner in the city, I'm like, yeah, I could take that or leave it, you know, like walking through the streets that smell like pee and and having to like duck around the manhole covers that are like steaming out, you know, the poop smells from the subway. It's like, oh, I could take that or leave it, you know? But okay, all seriousness, all jokes aside, and not all seriousness aside, let's wrap up. And I know we don't have a ton of time, but let's wrap up with what are some of your non-negotiable keys for creating deep and lasting intimacy that people can focus in on, whether they are new in a relationship or that they are, you know, they're a decade into a relationship. Where should people begin?
The thing that comes to mind immediately, I think if I could even just say one thing, because maybe I have a few keys for you, but I'll double down on this one thing to start. The thing that's going to build your relationship more than anything is the action that you take in the relationship that requires energy from you to genuinely enrich your partner's life. Hmm. I think when you boil down stuff like the love languages, that's the big idea. Like there's a lot of talk on, okay, well, my partner really loves compliments and having long conversations, or they want to, or they're recreational. They want to go out and do a bunch of stuff. They're more social. They're more introverted. They really love this or that. I'm like, ultimately, you probably have the intuitions around what your partner likes and doesn't like. That's probably how you got them in the first place. Like, at least you knew them when you were dating. The energy came really naturally to you because it was novel and there was a bit of a chase. It was fun. And, you were getting to know that person. And so there was kind of this new, fresh, you know, breath of discovery when you put in that effort. It was really nice. And when you get into new seasons of life that restrict you more, they restrict your freedom, like when you have kids, if you have a career situation where you don't have as much money to kind of go out and do all this stuff or to travel or something, it's easy to pick the most efficient, the activities that require the least amount of energy, because let's be real, you're spending that energy on kids and career and everything else. Then it can start to feel acceptable to put in low amounts of energy into your relationship. But I just want to remind you that intimacy, meaning the stuff that lights up your heart and when you see them, you actually feel good inside instead of like an undertone of anxiety or something. It's like that comes when you put energy into the relationship. And some examples of what I mean, it's like not just like cleaning up the house more so that you can get more sex, but thinking like what in her environment or his environment would make them feel more relaxed, more at peace, and take away more of their stress. Thinking really strategically, like the way I think is, okay, when she gets home, I want her, like I used to work at Apple, quick side note, and they were obsessive about the customer journey. So they half the orientation training was like, when they walk in the door, this happens, and then this happens, and this happens. They were just like religious on almost every step of that process being planned out and intentional. So they had just a breeze. You come in the Apple store, it's great. And you leave and you're happy. You know, now I walk in the Apple store and I'm like, I didn't have an appointment and it's a terrible experience and they don't want me there. But it's like, when I think about my partner, I want her to have an incredible experience as she walks through the door, and I think about this in my context, it's like, once we put the kids to bed, I want her to walk into the bedroom. And I started writing poetry for my wife. And that's something I hadn't done in a long time. I was in a band in college and used to like write songs and stuff and kind of just got out of it and got busy. And I was just like, man, I don't really write like songs or like write poems for her anymore. I used to do a lot of that. I should really put in some energy and time into doing that. So I would write her like a poem and then I'd have like a little mocktail, like something better than a lemonade, but not a drink, you know, just like sitting there ready for her and a cookie. And then I cleaned up the bedroom a bit and made the bed so that it feels really nice. And I get the lighting set, you know, just right. And that's not because I want to have any sort of like physical intimacy necessarily. It's just, I just want her to feel relaxed. I want her to come in and just feel relaxed. And then I know her favorite book and I have it sitting there. And I actually read the back cover of the book and I know what it's about. And I looked online. I don't want to read the whole book, but I read it online, like the kind of the loose like narrative of the fiction book she's reading. And so I'm asking her about it. And I remember what the characters are. And I take an interest in what she's reading, not because I care about the book, but because I care about her and I care about why she's interested. And man, I'll tell you what, that kind of energy comes back. It's electric. And then she's asking me, like, what are you reading in your psychology books? And tell me about, you know, what you're learning about fear associations and the lateral amygdala. And like, let me tell you, Paige, my wife does not care at all about the lateral amygdala. That is not relevant to her world in the slightest. But she genuinely will give me audience to just kind of verbally process what I just kind of like was learning that day in this book by Joe Ledoux that I've been reading. Because like, there's a reciprocal energy that we're putting into that. And I don't know, have you sat down and really strategized how to make your partner's day incredible? When's the last time you did that? Like, you really put all of your brain power into thinking like, okay, flowers, meals, just like whether it's cleanliness, recreational activity, the music that's on. What does your partner need to just feel amazing in the world? And can you just put all of your mental effort into making that more of a reality than it was before she walked in the room or he walked into the room? I'll tell you, if you just put brain energy into stuff like that, you're going to see a pretty big shift. I could give you some steps, I guess, like some stuff that rhymes. But ultimately, I think it comes down to just that conviction. I'm willing to put in energy into this. And my guess, just a last little side note, and we'll close it out, is like some of you listening to that were like, oh, but they don't put energy into me. Why would I go through all that when I just don't feel like that's offered? And I'm just like, I'll tell you what, I've given this assignment to dozens of clients. Specifically individual clients that I see that have a partner that they're upset with. Everyone who's followed it, in my experience, has come back happier that they tried it. Now, that doesn't mean it fixed the relationship. That doesn't mean it turned a bad relationship to a good one or that it untangled things that were problematic or toxic. I'm not saying any of that. I'm saying it was a net positive in every case, not just for them, but also in reception, because it just introduces a different energy into the relationship. There's a chemical reaction that happens emotionally when you put energy in like that, that the other person responds to. If at the very least, it puts them in a good mood. And you might like your partner more if they're in a good mood. And I just would say, give it a shot. Like, try it. Like, someone has to go first. And there's clearly more detailed things you can do if an intervention like that does not fix all your problems. I'm not claiming that it will, but that's a great place to start.
Well, maybe in part two, we will talk about both of our times at Apple, because I also work there, and then we'll get more into the trenches on some of these tactical pieces that you're talking about, and the things that rhyme that people can do.
Yeah, good.
Of the other conflict stuff. So, listen, brother, thank you so much for jumping on the show today. We're gonna have the links in the show notes, and I just want to say to everybody that's out there listening, this is definitely an episode that you need to man it forward. This is something that you should probably listen to with your partner. This is something that you should, you know, send to a friend and just chat about and kind of get into a conversation about. Because I think there's lots of topics in here that are worthy of sharing and conversing about. But for the people that want to learn more about you and your work and what you have to offer, where can they go to learn more about you?
Yeah, just say Matthias J. Barker on Instagram. You can go to MatthiasJBarker.com. You can find the couples workshop there. I have resources on relationships, trauma. That's kind of my main thing. So any social, Matthias J. Barker, that's the spot.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And for everyone out there that is tuning in, thank you so much for tuning in. And as always, until next week, this is Connor Beaton signing off.